Today is Friday, February 19th, 2016, and the time is 8 o'clock. We have a quorum of the Audit Committee. Susan Burton and Bill White is sitting in. And I now call the meeting of the Audit Committee of the Finance Commission of Texas to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. First order of business will be review and approval of the minutes of the December 17th, 2015 Audit Committee. These minutes were circulated to the members in the agenda packet. Are there any corrections to the minutes? Do I hear a motion to approve the minutes of the Finance Commission Audit Committee meeting held December 17, 2015?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Susan, seconded by Bill. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it and the motion passes. The next agenda item is the Audit Committee review of the agency's activities.
Madam Chair, for the Texas Department of Banking, I'd like to report again. Do we have no outstanding audit issues?
And for savings and mortgage lending, we also have no outstanding audit issues.
And for the Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner, on page 7, you'll see the report. We've had an item that's been we've been working on for some time, but we have completed that item and implemented modified procedures to maintain additional control and review over this particular professional licensing, so that will be coming off next time.
Great. We have none to discuss.
Well, then we'll go through the next round of audits.
We'll have lots to discuss. We'll have
speak for yourself.
I'm only speaking for me.
Thank you. The next item is a discussion of and possible vote to recommend that the Finance Commission take action on the agency's November 30th, 2015 investment officer reports.
Madam Chair, on page 9, we have the report of the Trust Prepaid Federal Guarantee Fund investment report. It ends with the balance as of November the 30th of $1,288,977. The activity that you see there, the ins and outs, basically what I'd call normal activity. If you don't have any questions, on the next page 10, the same, but it's for the insurance-funded prepaid guarantee fund, ending balance of $330,000, and also normal activity. Then on page 11, we have the seized funeral funds, and it shows the Shaw Funeral Home. It was about $25,000, and that contract has been awarded to FAI, and so that no longer works, if you will. That case is closed, and that is all of our activity.
Savings and mortgage lending begins on 13, and Antonio Antoff will give this report.
Good morning. Our report starts on page 13, and what's on page 13 is our list of CDs that we have with savings banks, and there is nothing new to report. There, on the next page, 14, is the Mortgage Recovery Trust Fund. Fund position as of November 30th, and there's nothing much to report here either. We haven't made any payments out of the recovery fund. There's several in progress, but there hasn't been any determination yet whether there will be payments or not.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And the Office of Consumer Credit report is on page 15, and Christina Cuellar would provide our report.
Good morning.
Good morning.
On page 15, we're starting with the endowment fund. I'd like to point out that we did have a grant disbursement in the amount of $32,453. For our invested portfolio, we did have a decrease in our change in value of about $19,000. So we did have a beginning balance of $3,095,000 And at the end of quarter, we did end up with $3,050,000. On the next page, for the residential mortgage loan originator, we had minimal change, nothing big, just the normal activity, and we ended up with about $122,000. Any questions?
Thanks, Kristen. Do I hear a motion to recommend that the Finance Commission approve the agency's November 30th, 2015 investment officer reports?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Bill, seconded by Susan. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
The ayes have it, and the motion passes. The next agenda item is discussion of and possible vote to recommend that the Finance Commission take action on the agency's 2016 first quarter financial statements.
Good morning. Sammy Chadley, Texas Department of Banking, County Director. If you go to page 17 is our operating statement as of November 2015. Our revenues are at 99.7% of expenditures, and our budget, and then our expenditures are at 96.3% of expenditures of budget. On page 18 is our variance explanations for first quarter. If you go to in-state travel, we have a positive variance that relates to vacant examiner positions, travel for examinations that occurred in late 15 but have been budgeted for 16, and overall efficient of staff and use, use of staff and resources. On rent buildings, we have a positive variance that is due to better negotiated pricing for the financial literacy workshops that we held. And also, we were charged an attendee fee, which offset, both of those offset a portion of the rental expenditures. And then for rent, machinery and other, the positive variance is also due to rental fee reduction through negotiation and waived audio and video fees for the same financial literacy workshops. Under auto operating, we do have a negative variance, and that is due to unbudgeted auto insurance expenditure, about $1,600. Landscaping around the building, as was recommended by DPS, and there was an increase in front desk receptionist allocated charges to the Department of Banking. That is due to a combination of higher volume to call volume to the Department of Banking, and lower call volume to OCCC than anticipated. And then the last item is subscriptions. Basically, we have positive variance, and that's basically we realized some cost savings by switching to electronic subscriptions versus hard copies. Do you have any questions? And then on page 19, that's our changes in cash balance and our assigned cash balance. We have a 3.57 months of assigned cash balance. Questions?
Thanks, Andy. And savings and mortgage lending begins on 21, and Antonio will present this report.
Okay, on page 21 is our first quarter report, and our revenues are 30% over budget. This is mostly due to higher penalties. We budgeted very low for penalties this year, and we're currently 1,100% of budget. We also received a second settlement from New Day Financial, which was not budgeted for, so that's that adds to the revenues. Their licensing revenues are 12%, 13% over budget, and right now we're going through renewals. So this is the higher activity of licensing revenues there. The expenditures are overall at 89% of budget, and the variance is mostly due to vacancies. The salaries and the benefits make up most of this amount. We have small variances in other categories, but the biggest portion is due to vacancies.
Remind me what mortgage enforcement means. When you say the $60,000 that you received will go to mortgage enforcement?
These are funds that we have received
from different settlements, funds that we had not anticipated receiving, and we did not think it's correct to spend it as part of the operating budget, so we have earmarked it for mortgage enforcement, and these are different things like sending employees to training for fraud, for investigation, or spending it in different trials. When we've had employees going to testify for in mortgage fraud trials.
The first time a settlement came in, mm-hmm. we earmarked it, as Antonio said, for mortgage fraud enforcement particularly, but mortgage enforcement in general potentially as well. Many states just take those funds into their operating budget. We did not want to do that. So we've used it for things like last year I reported that Stephen O. Shields was a witness in a fraud case in which there was a conviction. We used that to pay for those expenses rather than paying for things out of the assessments and fees that our industry that is not being penalized by lawsuits has made. So that's what
that makes perfect sense. I had just forgotten that.
Yes, certainly.
I apologize.
Sure, no problem.
If you have any questions, I'll be happy to address about the first quarter financials. On page 23 is our cash balance report, and you will notice that right now we are at 10.7 months of reserves, which is high, but this is just timing because first and second quarter we collect the revenues.
Right.
And then in the third and fourth quarter, this will go down.
Okay.
If you have any questions, I'll be happy to.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lieutenant.
Our financial statements start on page 25. And our overview of budget variances start on page 26. Our revenues are 156% of our budget. For our regulated lenders and our credit access business, both of them are above budget due to our timing of our renewal cycle, and they end in December, which is roughly our second quarter, so we'll see some changes in that during our second quarter financial statements. As far as our expenditures, those are 82% of our budget. Our professional fees are under budget, and this is due to our legal services not being incurred during our first quarter. For our acquisition of information technology, this is below budget due to our delay in some of our IT purchases. And for our development in progress, this is also under budget, and this is due to our timing in the beginning of our IT project for our annual reporting, complaints, and examinations. Any questions on that? On page 27, we have our changes in cash balance. And for that, we have a signed cash balance of 4.9 months. Any questions?
Thank you, Christine.
Thank you. Do I hear a motion to recommend that the Finance Commission approve the agency's 2016 first quarter financial statements?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Susan, seconded by Bill. Any discussion?
Another quarter, and we're still solvent.
Yeah. Nice. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion carries. The next order of business is a presentation from the Texas Treasury Safekeeping Company. Mr. Ballard is the CEO and Chief Investment Officer for Texas Treasury Safekeeping Company.
Good morning.
Good morning.
If I could take just a minute and thank Mr. Ballard for being here, and some of the members may recall that there was a request to kind of review in a little more depth sort of just an overview of how the Treasury Safekeeping Trust manages the endowment fund for the Financial Education Endowment Fund, and so that's why we've asked Mr. Ballard to be here. We appreciate him being here. So take it away.
It's my pleasure. What I've done is put together a presentation that kind of opens with who the heck is a trust company and then gets a little more deeply into the portfolio that we've built for the Consumer Credit Commission. So if you'll open to the first slide on page two, you know, just when the trust company came into being in 2001, and that came coincident with the state's settlement with the tobacco companies, where they received several billion dollars in settlement. Some of it was appropriated. $2.5 billion of it was set aside by a federal court to fund a tobacco endowment that would provide benefit to local hospital districts, and we've got about another $1 billion on top of that. So we've got about $3.5 billion worth of endowment money that we manage, representing 13 different endowments, and this being one of them. And currently, the value of the endowment is about $1.9 million and change, just south of $2 million.
Do you still enjoy being your smallest client?
Well, you know, I was kind of proud of that, to be honest with you. You are, and but we're able to, you know, the good news is, well, good news, bad news. A couple of sessions ago, when the legislature was having difficulty finding revenue and there were great concerns about future revenues, they had appropriated three endowments for the purpose of public health. And when you appropriate, you can reappropriate. So the permanent public health funds lost their status as permanent and became sources of cap, sources of revenue to fund secret bonds, the cancer bonds. So when they lost their permanent status, we had been funding them, much like all of our other endowments, with a lot of private equity, private real estate, venture capital, which really tend to be the return drivers, very illiquid, long-term types of investments. And so it was really no longer appropriate for them to hold those types of investments. So we started scratching our heads to try to figure out, well, how do we unwind these? And when y'all came in, we were able to basically buy you a slice of a fully mature private equity portfolio and a private real estate portfolio at net asset value, which would probably not be available in the secondary market, especially in the size. And so it's a real benefit to you all, which is what I'm kind of proud of, actually.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then the Veterans Fund was established, and they came in with, I think, $300 million. We were able to do the same for them, a fully mature private portfolio, which typically takes, we started building the portfolio in 2005, and it takes about 7 to 10 years for a private equity portfolio to become mature. I compare it to wheat and fruit. So public equities are like wheat. You know, you can put it to work immediately. They begin reacting to the market immediately. Private equity funds, typically you commit $10 million to a private equity fund. They draw that capital over about 5 years, and then they put it to work fixing a business or doing whatever they're going to do with it, and then they return capital to you over the next 5 years. So it's a full 10-year investment. And then you want to diversify by vintage year, because 2006 was an awful vintage year. 2007 and 2008 were great vintage years because, of course, the world collapsed and they were buying at very low prices. Anyway, so it's nice to have a mature portfolio, which we do have in here. And this slide three is simply a pie chart. So we manage a little over $50 billion in total assets, the largest of which is the state's operating fund, the Treasury Pool. And we manage that internally. We have our own trading desk. We actually have a Federal Reserve account. Texas is one of, I think, two states with a Federal Reserve account. There used to be quite a number of states with Federal Reserve accounts, but they didn't manage them carefully and lost the privilege. So we are extremely careful managing our settlements and custody area. So we run about $2 billion a day in trades through our Federal Reserve account, and we're able to settle and custody our own assets for the Treasury Pool, which saves us quite a few dollars in fees. Tax Pool Prime, their local government investment pools, where cities, counties, school district, park operating funds, and so forth, and trust accounts are separate accounts we manage for different state agencies, then the endowment funds, and then the $2 billion SWIFT fund was assigned to us a couple sessions ago. It's the State Water Implementation Fund, and so it's being used by the Water Development Board as a source of capital to subsidize bonds that they issue that will then finance local water projects. And it's designed to subsidize somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 billion worth of bonds over the course of the next 20 years. So it's different than the endowment in that it's a drawdown fund. It's a very long-term drawdown fund. And the endowments are permanent money. So that's ultimate long-term money. So the way I kind of describe our shop is we've got the Treasury Pool we manage at this end that is like an F-150 pickup truck. It's reliable. It starts every time you turn the key. You can pull a stump out of the ground with it. And it's got a lot of utility. And on the other end, the endowment funds, which is more like an F1 vehicle, very high tech, very complex strategies, a different investment objective. And then The SWIFT came to us, and it has a different objective than either one of these, so it's kind of in the middle. So we're able to pull tools from the F-1 shop and from the F-150 shop to build that. And so we've developed a capability to really construct investment pools, you know, kind of across the entire spectrum of needs. So
those SWIFT funds, are they available to municipalities, or who draws those?
Well, they are. What happened, I think the water, and I'm going to get out of my depth here in about 2 seconds, but the Water Development Board, I know, spends a lot of time out visiting with local communities to understand what water projects that they have planned, and then they have to understand what immediate project, you know, what's shovel ready and stuff like that. And then they prioritize, I think. And last year they issued a $1 billion bond in the fall and drew $108 million from the SWIFT. And it subsidizes the interest payments for the locals who are using those dollars.
Okay.
And then it's ultimately repaid. So 20 years from now, that money comes back.
Okay.
So it becomes kind of revolving.
Thank you.
You bet. And then page 4 is just an organization chart of the trust company. I came to the trust company in 2003, and along with a crew, actually we had been at the permanent school fund, and several of us moved over here. Danny Sachinwitz, who's my deputy, Frank Zahn, our chief financial officer, and Mike Samples, who's director of internal investments, he runs the treasury pool. Anyway, and so we've been building systems and processes and investment capabilities since 2003 over there. When they developed the trust company, I think they had an eye toward UTIMCO, if you all are familiar with UTIMCO, University of Texas Investment Management Company. They're an endowment that's been around for quite some time. They adopted what's known as the endowment investment model. Back in the early 90s, they started investing in private equity and private real estate. And those are really the return drivers. I mean, that's obviously the highest risk end of the spectrum, but if you diversify properly,
That's a gold standard, isn't it?
It is a gold standard. And they do a great job. And so I think the legislature looked at that and said, gee, I think we need one of these for the state that's just not the universities. And I think that's what they were looking to when they set up the trust company in 2001 to manage the tobacco endowments. So this is how we spread our portfolios, this next section. I've included an executive summary that's just kind of a narrative that talks about, you know, what it was. 2015 was an awful year. I've heard it called the worst year for pension funds since 2008. Really difficult year. You know, you had China devalue its currency. You had the China bubble pop. Oil took its second nosedive, it's down from, I think, $117 to what it dropped, obviously, as everybody in this room probably knows, below $30, and it's sitting around 31, I think, yesterday. This in September, you know, the game was watch the Federal Reserve. Are they going to raise interest rates? Are they going to crank them up in September? There was a huge chorus encouraging them to do so. They looked at the data and decided it probably wasn't worth the risk, because I think they're trying to reload their magazine with bullets, because they have very few. Should we roll into a recession, you know, when you're at zero, you really can't cut rates to stimulate. So I think they're slowly trying to ratchet it up, being mindful of not stalling this kind of nascent recovery that we have going on presently. So everybody was gaming that, and didn't happen in September. A lot of people were disappointed, and the markets got choppy. It finally happened in December, and everyone was kind of positioned for, including us, for rising interest rates. We've been positioned for rising interest rates for longer than I'd like to admit. And as things kind of normalize, the markets have had a tailwind of kind of Federal Reserve support for, you know, since March of 2009. And so it's just like we walk through the looking glass. So bad news is good news. So if you get a bad economic number, the market's thrilled to death because they know the Fed's not going to tighten. And they may ease. And so the markets rise because, you know, obviously the value of an equity is a discounted cash flow. The present value of future cash flows, and the lower the discount rate, obviously, the higher the present value. So as rates go up, you know, valuations are inclined to go down. And so bad news became good news because it meant lower interest rates, you know, higher present values. And I think we've kind of pulled returns forward for about 3 years in the equity markets. So that's where we find ourselves now, is things are fairly priced. And then oil happened, and it had an impact. I'll just walk through the book and we can talk about sections of it. Page 6 is the asset allocation summary. I've included in behind tab two our investment policy, because how we go about constructing a portfolio is we work with a consultant, asset consulting group, and there's a kind of an industry best practice approach to putting together a portfolio that's designed to achieve target return. In our case, it's inflation plus five, with the least amount of risk, and risk being defined as volatility, price volatility. And, you know, you combine assets in a certain fashion to do that. We went through that process. Out of that comes the asset allocation policy, which is kind of the most important decision. And that's what's before you here is the asset allocation policy. So you can see where we stood at September 30. And I would like, I can't give you December 31 a written report. The controller, we report to, obviously the state controller is our sole shareholder, chairman of our board. We're technically a separate state agency, a wholly owned subsidiary of the controller's office. And he has an investment advisory board that's comprised of really of buy-side experts, the guy that runs the TCU endowment, the guy that used to run the Rice endowment. We've got someone that runs a real estate investment practice, a family office that invests primarily in oil and gas, someone that works for a large trust company in Houston that markets the endowment product and kind of gets it. And then we've got a CPA, a former KPMG partner who asks, he plays a great role. He asks control questions. He's always wanting to know about controls and, you know, what have we done for disaster recovery, those types of questions. So we've got a really great board. And we presented them quarterly. So we'll be giving them December numbers in March. And, you know, I've always learned to follow the rule, never tell anybody anything before you've told your boss. And so, you know, once we report to them the December numbers, we'll put them online. We have a website, ttstc.com, where we keep all this stuff. It's posted, results, asset allocation policies, audits. We receive multiple audits every year. And those are all posted online, information about our board members and our staff and so forth. So you can see, I mean, the good news, I guess, in looking at this asset allocation is that your portfolio, and we had to kind of decompose it out of the $3.5 billion, so we've got a quantitative staff that kind of extracted the information on this portfolio. Is you've got a slight overweight to private equity, which is great because that's been a big return driver and should continue to be so. And underweight global inflation-linked bonds down under real assets and natural resources, which was an awful, awful place to be last year. Those were probably down 30%, but they're a small fraction of the portfolio. And they're there for inflation protection, which no one seems to believe we'll ever see again. And at least that's the way those assets are priced, which is probably a good time to be putting a little money to work there. You know, if you look at the economy, there are a lot of negatives, but there are some positives. Household formations are starting to increase. Housing is starting to pick up. And so those are obviously, as you guys know.
Household formation defined as what? What do you
mean? As families forming.
Families coming together.
So 30-year-olds moving out of their parents' basements. And and then they will hopefully become home buyers, and new home construction pick up a little bit. Rents are very tight right now, so if you look at multifamily, vacancy rates are low, rents are going up. We're actually invested in a strategy, if you guys, how much time do I have here? I'll wear you out, I'm afraid.
We got about five more minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We're actually invested in a strategy. It's buy-to-rent strategy. So we buy single-family homes and rent them. And we own about 2,500 homes right now that are diversified geographically. There's a firm here in town called Amherst Securities that really cracked the code on that, presented it to the Federal Reserve when they were looking for ways to offload all the REO that they had picked up back in 2008, 9, 10. And it's a strategy that's worked incredibly well. You can basically, the net yield on the assets is 4.75% to 5%, and that assumes no rent appreciation or home price appreciation. And so if you factor that in, we expect an internal rate of return of, you know, low to mid-teens, probably on a pretty safe investment. Anyway, that's what's one of the more interesting things we've done. Again, flip to page 8, that's the geographical diversification by asset class. We're slightly U.S.-centric in the portfolio relative to the MSCI ACWI, which is the All Country World Index, which is our equity benchmark, and the Barclays Multiverse, which is our fixed income benchmark. So you can see we've got a little more U.S. Domiciled assets in the portfolio than those two benchmarks. The fixed income summary, this is kind of a, this, you know, looks like a blank music sheet, I know, but we aren't able to generate statistically valid numbers until we have about 36 months worth of data, and this portfolio is only about 2.5 years old. So as we get more data, obviously we can fill in the blanks here, but I can tell you that in fixed income, you know, the first column past portfolio weight is standard deviation, which is volatility, which is risk. And you can see that the multiverse, the global fixed income, high-grade fixed income market, has a standard deviation of 3.8. Our overall portfolio is 2.7. We have a sharp ratio over 1, which is basically a measure of how well you're being paid for the risk you're taking, and the total portfolio. A downside deviation, which means, you know, the downside risk is 3.4 in our portfolio overall versus 4.1 for the multiverse. Maximum drawdown, that's peak to trough over any period of time in the last 5 years, 7% for the multiverse, 3% for our portfolio, and then number of positive months, 44% of the time multiverse puts up a positive number, 72% of the time we do in the overall portfolio. But it's comprised of traditional fixed income and what we call alternative fixed income. And alternative is a strategies that are designed to be uncorrelated with equities, which is what you do, what you want out of your bond portfolio. It's kind of the anchor to windward and a diversifier. And this further diversifies the portfolio.
Paul, can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
On your alternatives, both sides, equity, fixed income, you mostly invested in like ETFs, mutual funds, or do you have a, and this question was brought up by our auditors. Okay. We have a lot of alternative exposure in here.
A lot.
And they were concerned that it's non-liquid or illiquid, whatever you want to call it. And I guess that would be my question, because I know the private debt and the private equity is not liquid, because we're tied into something that's, what, 20-something percent of something, I can't even remember.
Yeah, yes.
But, so how non-liquid is this portfolio? I mean, I think we need to know.
Sure. We monitor that, and we actually have liquidity rules in the investment policy. And so the alternative stuff typically requires at least a one-year lockup, sometimes a two-year lockup, and then you get quarterly liquidity thereafter. So when you've got a more portfolio you've been building over the years, you tend to have a lot of those lockups that have run off, and there's probably 25% turnover in managers. So new managers brought on, you've got longer lockups. And some strategies you want longer lockups because they will take positions that they don't expect a catalyst to unlock that value for, you know, maybe a year or two. And so you have to have patience. And certainly in high yield right now, you've got to have a lot of patience.
So we get dividends on that? Obviously something has to be generated.
And we have lots of liquid stuff. We can meet all our, we have capital calls constantly. So we have, you know, cash flow meetings every month to make sure we've got plenty of cash available for both capital calls from, you know, private equity, private real estate, private credit, as well as distributions that are being required by any of our.
Was your question to the point of the percentages of?
The percentages on last.
My sense was that we deal with that somewhat by maintaining a fairly large cash balance.
We do, and in fact, we're pretty close to needing to invest some more,
right,
because of balance has grown so large. But yeah, we maintain a very healthy cash balance so that we have the availability to meet any cash needs,
right,
we would have.
So y'all maintain cash outside of this fund?
Yeah, because we're receiving annually,
right,
revenue into it, which then we'll make a new investment. I mean, that's coming up. We need to do that.
Okay. But because we started with $1.4 million, I know,
right,
in March of 2013, and got another $500,000.
And we're ready to go about another $500,000,
right,
again.
Okay.
$600,000. Yeah.
Okay.
And that really is the key. I lived in Fort Worth for many years, and our buying barometer was watching what the Bass Brothers did.
Yeah,
but
pretty good.
But
monitor,
the key was
good.
You had to have staying power. They were rarely ever wrong on because they were bottom buyers.
Yep.
But you had to have the staying power because nobody knows exactly where a bottom of a
catch a falling knife.
That was it, yeah.
Theory, that's exactly, and they do a great job of that.
Yeah.
In fact, the real estate person on our board used to manage real estate for the Ray Hunt family. So, you know, she understands their approach. And, you know, so we, the problem in this business is you're either a hero or a goat. It's not, there's not a lot of in-between. And you've got to be willing to look stupid for, you know, for extended periods of time.
You could have truncated this meeting by kind of saying, I'm a hero right now.
I claim it either right now.
That's as opposed to looking stupid having bought up the top.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So we've got, we've actually got an energy fund in here that's about half funded, and it's a fixed income fund, and they're out there. They're long and short, and they're, you know, energy just trashed everything. And a lot of, anything that had anything to do with energy, whether it was pipelines, whether it was, you know, EMP, got thrown out the window. And so a lot of babies flew out the window with the bathwater. And so we've got a guy who's trying to catch the babies. And we're doing the same in Europe. We've got some distressed debt funds who are, now that the European banks are starting to unload because they've got Basel III and are having to meet the new capital requirements, we've got some distressed managers looking for the same thing over there. And we've got private credit. One of our strategies is, you know, go where the banks can't go. And because of Dodd-Frank and the Volcker Rule, that's changed a lot. And there are a lot of loans, and banks are having new capital requirements. And there are loans banks can't make or don't want to carry on their books as a scheduled item. But we have investment managers who have no problems doing that. They can, you know, they can take varied loan payments that would be have to be carried as a scheduled item on a bank balance sheet. But, you know, these guys are, you know, we can be flexible enough, right? And so it kind of helps take banks out of those. If you've got mergers, the buying bank typically doesn't want to buy a bunch of scheduled items, so they're looking to sell that portfolio off. And we have some strategies that are buying those portfolios. So, I'm sorry, I'm running out of time here. Fixed income detail on the next page, on page 10. We basically are short duration and heavy yield, so which means we have traded interest rate risk for credit risk. So the portfolio is kind of short maturity, short duration, has less sensitivity to rising rates than a traditional portfolio, and we have a higher yield because we have a higher concentration in corporate fixed income. And corporate fixed income had a lousy year last year, and typically that's, you know, historically been followed by some pretty good times, but you know, that's not a hard rule. God didn't make that rule. That's product of,
darn it.
That's a product of some kind of economic physics, and we're doing a lot of work on that right now, because if that does, you know, appear to be true, all the marketing guys say it is, but if that does, if we do have high confidence in that, we will continue to put more money to work there. Private debt, we've broken into performing and distressed, and the performing has been producing better returns in distressed, which is the opposite of what you would expect. But that's because the distressed strategies take a long time. They'll buy bankrupt companies. They're, you know, they're experts in working companies through bankruptcy. And that's just a much longer process. The performing guys are generating positive cash flow immediately. And so they've been outperforming recently. That'll turn around eventually. Equity, we have broken those global, which is long-only equity. And that, it's, there are 12 managers in that portfolio. Five of them are what we call enhanced index managers. And the remainder are what we call activist managers. And activist managers, basically, they're not all Bill Ackman. We don't invest in Pershing Square. But they basically will go into a public company like GE or Microsoft and have a plan to unlock value in the company. And they will take board seats, and they will, you know, basically try to encourage the board to adopt their plan. One of our managers has board seats on GE and another one on Microsoft, Valiant. Valiant Pharmaceuticals, who everybody hates because they bought companies and jacked up prices. One of our managers took a board seat many years ago, and we've actually made a lot of money on Valiant Pharmaceuticals despite its recent sell-off. I mean, I hate them myself because I don't ethically agree with what they're doing with pricing, but managers will do that. They'll go in and improve. And we think there's a better opportunity to create value there than just trying to buy a manager who's a good stock picker. Hedged equity, we use hedged equity really because it's less volatile, has better downside protection than long-only equity, and our expectation is that hedged equity will produce the same return as long-only equity over a full investment cycle with probably a third or more or less risk. So, I mean, that's we're very downside-focused. We tend to be more defensive than most. And over a five-year period, I can tell you that the private equity portfolio including hedge, put up a 6.8% annualized return, and the All-Country World Index put up a 7% return, and our portfolio had 44% less risk. So, I mean, that's our objective. Private equity, you own 37 buyout funds, and you have 10 venture capital funds. And $88,000 got you 10 venture capital. Most of these guys have $10 million minimums.
Yeah.
Right? Same with the hedge funds. They tend to have, anywhere from 2 to 10. And some of these hedge funds are closed. You can't get into them. We're in a couple of Bridgewater funds, and they've been closed for years. But we have capacity in those. Real assets, we have stable and enhanced real estate. Stable real estate tend to be, downtown office buildings that are 95-98% leased to high-quality clients. Most of your return will come from cash flow as opposed to appreciation. Enhanced, you have everything from greenfield development to buying a broken property, a B property, and upgrading it to an A property. But there's development risk and there's lease-up risk in enhanced, and you tend to get paid better for that than you do buying a more conservative, stable value stuff. And then we've got it broken down by sector and how we're invested. We actually have some timber and infrastructure in here because when we got started with the stable value part of the portfolio, the stuff was just overpriced in our mind. And so we looked for something that was similar. And so it's timber's not done great because housing hasn't done well. Infrastructure, it's European infrastructure, did great, but then the dollar recently has hurt the value of the euro, and that's hurt the return on that particular piece, but all things are cyclical. And then inflation-linked bonds and natural resources, this was really the dog part of the portfolio. It hurt the most because, again, nobody's believing in inflation, so they sold off really with oil. Oil started it, and then the China slowdown kind of continued it because China was the biggest buyer of natural resources. And so when China, everybody started getting worried about a China slowdown or hard landing, commodities, prices got hurt. And, of course, oil really kind of started the train. And then the last strategy is all asset strategies. And this is primarily a strategy called risk parity, which is a new way of building a diversified portfolio where they diversify the risk characteristics of the portfolio. It's stocks and bonds, long only, but it's constructed differently. And so 65-35 is a traditional, or 60-40 stock-bond mix. But 95% of the risk is stocks because they're so much riskier than bonds. So it's really kind of semantic diversification. These guys build a portfolio that they measure the risks and all those components and balance the risks. So they will lever up the fixed income part of the portfolio so that the risk it presents is equal to the risk of equities so that they're more balanced. It's another Bridgewater product, and they were the first actually to come up with it. A lot of people are offering risk parity products today. And then this is our risk analysis, the next couple of pages. We monitor this. We actually have a risk budget. For the portfolio, we have guidelines, minimum and maximum amounts of risk we can take in the overall portfolio, which is the speedometer down there on the left. You can see where we were at 630, and where the policy is, and the min and max, and then the average over 12 months. And we've never really kind of gotten close to either the min or the minimum or the max, maximum. And then the bar chart on the right shows you where the risk comes from. You can see the green is the allocation. So you can see the big allocation to fixed income, but a very small contributor to risk. And then you drop down to equity, and you can see the green is a shorter bar than the risk. So it really is a major contributor to risk, real assets, and so forth. And then we crash test the portfolios regularly. And this portfolio stress test, just as an indicator of how our policy portfolio, were it invested in just indexes, would perform relative to a traditional 65-35 stock bond portfolio in times of these basic, we've laid out a number of different scenarios here, but how our portfolio would be expected to respond, which is less dramatically on the downside. So it's not, you can't defy gravity, but we think it's more defensive than most. And then the returns, and I apologize, this page 20, I was looking at this last night before I left the office, and I was kind of going through all these pages for one last time, and I looked at the return for 2014, and it just didn't feel right to me, it didn't look right. And so I went to our, basically a custodian and pulled up the numbers and the return for the year was actually 1.64, not minus 4 basis points. I don't know how that happened. I apologize. We had some issues with our graphic designer yesterday. And anyhow, so it's ugly, but I hand corrected that. So, I'm glad it wasn't. I'm not telling you it was 164 minus 04.
It was a
banner year. Yeah. And this year, I think you can probably expect it, without disclosing too much, we're going to see a flat year. And then you've got your investment policy, and then what you'll have is the statute that established this account in the back. And that's really all
That's really great information. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, thank you very much.
Does this meet the needs, member?
Yes.
Your questions? Okay.
So we're the smallest client, but you make us feel like we're your biggest client.
Well, heck, $2 million is real money as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And I can't think of a more colorful or metaphor-rich presentation that we've ever seen.
Absolutely not. I'm between knives, babies.
Trucks.
It's a perfect looking glass.
That's the perfect country and western song.
We appreciate the opportunity working with the Safe TV Trust Company. They've been excellent to work with and consummate professionals. We really appreciate the work they do.
Thanks a million.
Thanks, Paul.
We appreciate it. When you crash test these things and we're not in there, you leave us out of the car.
We hope we don't have one of those crashes again. We had 2000. This portfolio was funded in 2000, just before the tech bubble crash.
Yeah.
And then, so we had that in 2000, 2001, and then we got 2008. So we really had a bit of rough sledding.
Who was it? Who was the comedian, the humorist, who said, "I'm more interested in a return of my money than a return on my money"?
Will Rogers. Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.
Leslie, thank you for setting
up. Oh, sure.
Yeah, that was excellent. And the last agenda item is a report on the activities relating to the Texas Financial Education Endowment Fund.
So that's on page 29. It's just a really brief report. We went through the second cycle and have been working with those new grant recipients. And so there's a written report. We'll have a more formal report at your next meeting that recaps the first cycle. So if you have any questions, Juan's available, but the information is there. And then if I could just take a brief moment of personal privilege to express our sincere gratitude to Dana Edgerton. I don't think she's in the room right now, but I appreciate her dedication and commitment to the Financial Education Endowment Fund and program. She shepherded this program through its early beginnings and on to its second cycle. She's leaving us in mid-March to begin a new chapter in her life, one that she's been planning for a long time. So we want to thank her for her service, and we're going to wish her all the best. But I want to let you all know. And with that, that concludes my report.
There being no further business, this meeting of the Audit Committee of the Finance Commission of Texas is now adjourned. The time is 8:47.